This is Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Dogcast Radio. On this episode, you can learn about one of the first designer breeds, the Labradoodle.
With all the different hybrids that are out there now, the unique thing about the Labradoodle is that this is a hybrid that was created with intent.
What do you think of dog crates? More to the point, what do you think your dog thinks of dog crates? Well, we have expert advice from Lynn Richards.
Dogs are naturally denning animals, and they need a small space that's safe and secure, especially when they're young.
And in Buddy's diary, Buddy tells us how hard it can be for dogs to recognise one another.
Okay, we've all got four legs, and most of the other bits are the same. But then it can all be on show in a short, smooth coat, or cunningly disguised in a long, shaggy one.
But first, we go to our breed profile, which is the Labradoodle. Edie McKenzie is the author of The Definitive Guide to the Labradoodle. And the first thing we talked about was why the Labradoodle was created.
Well, the Labradoodle was actually, with all the different hybrids that are out there now, the unique thing about the Labradoodle is that this is a hybrid that was created with intent to fill a void in the dog world. There was a need for an allergy-friendly guide dog, and it began with a woman in Hawaii going to the Guide Dog Association, and I'm not sure I have that name 100% correct, but it's the Guide Dog Association in Australia, looking for an allergy-friendly guide dog because her husband was allergic to dogs.
Oh, right.
And there was a gentleman there who worked there. His name was Wally Cochran, and he worked with breeding the labs and the poodles. And they sent upwards to about 30 different samples out to this woman and her husband in Hawaii of, you know, the dog fur and all of that. And then they finally came up with a puppy that had the fur that didn't bother her husband's allergies. And this first puppy's name was Sultan. I remember that much. His name was Sultan, and he was the first allergy-friendly guide dog. Oh. And the Guide Dog Association, I believe, of Victoria still is breeding Labradoodles, a straight cross of, you know, of a lab and a poodle. And also I know that there are Guide Dog associations here in the United States that also breed them for that purpose. So they were bred with intent.
Mm, yeah. And, I mean, you've just sort of mentioned it there a little bit, sort of there's this difference between sort of this, the straight, you know, the lab poodle cross and then Labradoodles bred from other Labradoodles.
Well, it's interesting because there's definitely two different breeding philosophies, and I get into this quite a bit in my book. It's kind of the heart of the book. As time went on, there were things within that first cross of the lab and the poodle, and that they wanted, because it is a hybrid from one of two different types of dogs, you don't get the same consistency in your litters. So you don't get the same consistency in the allergy-friendly coats and looks and appearance and everything else. So there were two people, Beverly Manners at Rutland Manor and Angela Cunningham at Teagan Park, and the two of them worked to develop and bring about what's now known as the Australian Multigen Labradoodle. And this particular Labradoodle has other breeds in there, and I know that there's like a Portuguese water dog, an Irish water spaniel, that they brought in some other breeds to strengthen different components, to set the coats and to create a more consistent a more consistent dog. And again, there's two schools of thought there. So you've got this line here, which has a lot of benefits and advantages, but then you also have the direct, advantage of hybrid vigor that comes with the direct breeding of, a poodle and a lab. So, and both of them breed wonderful pets.
Mm.
They both breed wonderful pets, and they both breed wonderful service dogs.
Mm. But there's more predictability about sort of the coat type of things with the...
There is more predictability with the Australian multi-gen, yes, at this point in time, after all these years of breeding, in terms of their being allergy-friendly.
Mm.
With the first crosses, which are known as an F1, statistically, you're only going to get 10 to 15% of any given litter that is going to be non-shedding or allergy-friendly. So that's part of why, there was work to develop a more consistently allergy-friendly dog.
But character-wise, are they quite similar still?
You know, so much depends on the breeding. With the Australian multigens, there's definitely been a tremendous focus on developing and maintaining that intuitive nature in the dogs. The challenge that comes in when you've got your F1, your first cross, is that you're really depending upon the temperament of the parent dogs. And that can be, as we all know, we've all met hyper poodles, we've all met hyper labs.
Mm.
You put a hyper poodle and a hyper lab together, you're going to get hyper puppies. And I'm not meaning hyper like, regular puppy energy. I'm talking over the top. But then if you get a mellow lab and a nice, gentle, mellow poodle, you're going to get that temperament will translate to the puppies. So you have to be more cautious with the first, in my opinion, with the first crosses, because there's not been the breeding history hasn't been there. Whereas with the Australian multigens, there has been a real focus on breeding for the mild, biddable temperament and that intuitive nature. And that's not to say that you can't get that with the F1s and the first crosses. It's just that, unfortunately, with the popularity of the Labradoodles, what you end up finding, and at least here in the States, what we're finding is a lot of, backyard breeders who are, oh, I've got a poodle, you've got a lab, let's make some money. They're not always looking at what's going to ultimately make the best dog.
No. I suppose that's true with any breed, isn't it? If somebody unscrupulous.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a real issue here, in a lot of the purebred dogs, just because they have been so overbred. I was just reading something the other day on the golden retrievers, and they have a very high cancer rate because they're starting to be overbred, and just general health issues that are really becoming prominent in a lot of purebred dogs. And in that regard, that's where this first cross Labradoodle can be. They have the hybrid vigor of a cross. The only thing you have to be careful of is any genetic issues that are common to both breeds.
The other thing that I've heard about the Labradoodle is it is intelligent.
Extremely.
But if you don't channel that intelligence, it's going to be mischievous sort of thing.
You will be in trouble. You will be in trouble. They are extremely intelligent dogs, and they've been bred that way. You just put the poodle in. The poodle is one of the most intelligent dogs out there, and there is this innate intelligence that if you don't keep them challenged, you're going to have behavioral problems with them. You really need to keep them challenged. They excel at, you know, agility and in obedience class. Very often they're the puppy that gets chosen to be the example in obedience classes. I have several friends who are trainers, and they love it when the Labradoodles come through their classes.
Mm.
But it's definitely a dog that needs to have somebody who will be willing to put in the time to train them. Not a dog that you want to leave locked up 8 hours a day and then come home and expect them to behave.
No. I was just thinking, I used to teach, and with the children, the intelligent ones, they went one of two ways. Either they were sort of good, in inverted commas, and sort of worked and were intelligent, or if you weren't giving them work that was stimulating them, they became the naughty ones.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have been told that they're either going to be, you know, an absolute star or just an absolute brat child.
Yes.
To quote somebody, a very well-known breeder, and that if they are not challenged, you can have problems. But yet, you know, if you're willing to take the time and energy to put into it, you will have an absolutely amazing dog. Because they are wonderful, wonderful companions.
What are they like within a family? Do they bond with the whole family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do. They do. And I think with any dog, there's always that one person who it's their dog. You know, there's that primary person who they look to as being, you know, the leader. But they are really good family. They're really good family dogs. They're very good with kids. But again, with any dog, you know, if you have young children, you have to be careful with puppies around small children and that. But they are very good with children, very good with families.
I think the thing is, when we say, you know, they're good with children, what we mean is really, you know, they are fairly tolerant. But with any dog, it's how good are the children with the dog.
And that's a big factor. You have to really, you've got to be careful. You can't leave young children and young dogs alone together, in my opinion. I think you need to, it needs to all be very well supervised, and if it's not going to be supervised, then the puppy needs to go into their kennel and give a little time out. And, you know, sometimes puppies do need a little time out from if there's a lot of small children around, because they get overstimulated and they need that break.
We've said about, you know, the hybrid vigor which they have. Are there any health issues with them?
Yes, there are. There are, in particular, the primary one that people who are buying the first cross need to be aware of, and actually with any of the Labradoodles, with the multigens as well, they need to be aware of hip dysplasia. That is a genetic disorder that is common to both Labrador retrievers and to the standard poodle. So they want to make sure that they are getting the documents and see the hip scores for the sire and the dam, and understand the hip scores and know that they are good. And it doesn't guarantee that the puppy will never have hip dysplasia, but it gives you it's a fairly good indicator that the puppy will not develop it. But that is the one thing. And then when you get into some of the miniature versions, miniature poodles and the tend to have issues with their elbows, and it's the same thing. You want to make sure that they've got the OFA testing on the on their elbows. So a lot of it's just making sure that the testing has been done on the sire and the dam, and that the scores that they've received are good.
Presumably, is that harder to do? Because, I mean, I don't know the situation in America, but in England, I don't think the Labradoodle isn't sort of Kennel Club registered.
Oh, the testing can be done with, you know, at any veterinarian, and any responsible breeder who knows that this is a genetic issue with their particular breed is going to get score, you know, have the hips tested on their breeding dogs. And if they haven't, well, you might want to be looking at a different breeder.
No. I was just thinking with it being sort of not registered, I suppose it's less legislated about, or sort of less set out for them what they need to do, isn't it?
Well, it is. It isn't. There are governing bodies that oversee and have codes of ethics that Labradoodle breeders need to go by. One is the Labradoodle Association of Australia, and then the International Labradoodle Association. And then we also have here in America the Australian Labradoodle Club of America. And all of these organizations have a code of ethics that their member breeders have to agree to and abide by when they're breeding. And the LAA, the Labradoodle Association of Australia, and the ILA, the International Labradoodle Association, recognize both the Australian multi-gen Labradoodle and the F1, which is the first cross, and various derivations in between. They recognize all of those as Labradoodles. And so you can find breeders that are breeding the Australian Labradoodles or these first cross Labradoodles, and like I said, the other derivations that do have a code of ethics that they go by. And those code of ethics do include health testing of the sire and dam.
Good. I didn't realize that. Good.
Yeah. I think they're really wonderful, wonderful dogs. I think that it's very, very important that before somebody purchase one, that they find out the different types of Labradoodles and understand that not all Labradoodles are allergy friendly, and that you really need to make sure that you get your Labradoodle from a reputable breeder who is breeding for health and for temperament. Because very often people who are looking at Labradoodles are first-time dog owners because they've had allergies and they've never been able to have a dog before. And this is their first opportunity to actually have a big dog. So you really want to make sure that you're getting a dog that's got that sweet, gentle temperament that they're known for. Because if you're a first-time dog owner and you end up with a really hyper dog, it's really frustrating.
And you don't have the strategies.
Frustrating when you have a lot of experience with dogs. Never mind it being your very first one.
But I mean, you've built up your store of strategies, and if you try one thing and it doesn't work, you can try something else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's where finding a really good trainer in your area is really important. Finding reading, there's a tremendous number of resources out there now for training your dog. And when one is training a dog, I have always pick and chose from this works with this dog and this works with that dog, and okay, this methodology is working for this particular thing I want to teach. It's not working for this one, so I think I'll try this methodology. So I think there's just so many resources out there now for dog owners to be able to learn to train their dogs, and that it's great. And here in the States, the other thing that we've got is the advent of dog parks, which is an absolutely marvelous, marvelous tool for socializing your dog, which is critical it's critical to have a well-socialized dog. And they have an awful lot of doodle romps at dog parks. We have doodle romps here. Well, they have them in Australia as well, but they have doodle romps here where people who own doodles, golden doodles, labradoodles, and some of the other doodles, and they will get everybody together, and they'll meet at a dog park, and it's just such great fun. And it's quiet.
Yes.
These are not noisy dogs. They're not real barkers, which is, owning a barking dog, I can definitely appreciate a dog that doesn't bark very much.
There are many myths about hypoallergenic dogs, and this area is fraught with misunderstanding.
That was actually one of my motivations when I to write. It started me thinking about writing the book. First it was is that I wanted to add a third dog to our family here, and my husband is allergic to the two that we already have. So I said, okay, I wanted a larger dog. I love the lab personality. And so I started doing research, but what I found is that there was just a ton of information all over the place that didn't really, there wasn't anything all in one place to tell me about that tells about the different types of Labradoodles, because there's the F1s, then you've got F1Bs, F2s, the Australian multigens, and there's even more beyond that. Mm. I mean, I discuss four different types in my book. So there was that component, but then I started seeing occasionally, not very often, because most Labradoodles, if they need to be rehomed, are rehomed by Labradoodle organizations, or by, Labradoodle owners contacting and making contact and that. But occasionally you will see, and generally it's the first crosses, the F1s, you will see a Labradoodle out on petfinder.org, which is the ASPCA's website.
Hmm.
And very often it is because they ended up, that they shed or they caused allergies within the family. And people thought they were getting a Labradoodle, and without really understanding that not all Labradoodles are allergy friendly.
I mean, it's a fascinating subject. Even puppies within the same litter, you may find one that doesn't provoke your allergies, but another one will.
Oh, absolutely, and this is particularly true with the F1, that first cross Labradoodle, because as I said, statistically, only 10 to 15% of that any given litter is going to be allergy friendly. So you may get, hypothetically, if you have, eight puppies, one maybe might be allergy friendly.
Well, if that's whetted your appetite to find out more about the Labradoodle, and they are a lovely breed, there's a link on our site to Edie's book.
Dogs and Mythology. Argus was Ulysses' hunting dog. When Ulysses came home after a 20-year absence, disguised as a beggar, only Argus recognised him.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. Buddy's Diary.
Hello, Buddy the Black Labrador here. Life can be pretty confusing when you're a dog, you know. You humans have it easy. You're all roughly the same shape and height and design, and it must be easy to recognise each other. We dogs have an enormous amount of variety in the way we can look. We're not all normal-looking Labradors. Okay, we've all got four legs, and most of the other bits are the same, but then it can all be on show in a short, smooth coat, or cunningly disguised in a long, shaggy one. Then there's the size difference. We can be anything from about 3 inches to nearly 3 feet. Then there are the really individual breeds, the dreadlocked, the bald, and even the wrinkly. Of course, this is all part of what makes us appealing to you humans, but it can have repercussions for us canines. For example, when I'm out on my walk, I meet other dogs, which is great. Being a dog, it's very easy to spot another dog, trot up to one another, have a play, then make a cheery farewell, and carry on with our constitutionals. However, occasionally, I have met some puzzling creatures. On one occasion, I was aware that there was another dog in the vicinity, because for one thing, I could smell one close by. Then I could hear one announcing its presence in short, sharp staccato barks. I was puzzled and looked around, but could only see a human with a tiny creature on a lead. It was only when I looked closely and saw that when the little creature opened its mouth I could hear the barking sound that I realised that was actually the dog. I did a play bow and wanted to go and have some fun, but I was pulled away. He kept up his barking, shouting at me very rudely, "I'm here, here I am, notice me, look at me." He wasn't hauled away for his rudeness. His people just laughed. Now, don't misunderstand. I am not sizist. I don't care how big or small a dog is, as long as they play nicely. Never judge a dog by the length of its leg, that's my motto. Mind you, saying that, we used to have a very strange fellow lived in our house. Very short-legged dog. I could never understand a word he said. And he had a nervous twitch around the nose. Turned out he was a rabbit. So all my trying to pal up with him was in vain. At the other end of the spectrum, I was rather confounded the first time my family took me with them to somewhere called the stables. Here, there are dogs so big, and I mean enormous. They wear seats on their backs, and people sit on them instead of leading them by their side. Again, these giants spoke a very strange language, but they smelt all right, so I dogfully made friendly overtures with a spot of barking and playful jumping. You guessed it. I was tugged away from them and kept at a frustrating distance. Turns out they're horses, but I've never been allowed close enough to investigate them in depth. You see, the four-legged thing can be a red herring. Cats were a huge surprise to me. They've got the right number of limbs, they're furry, they smell lovely, but as soon as you initiate a bit of rough and tumble, wallop, they scratch you right on the nose. Then they run away and jump up to the top of the fence, where they sit smugly, lacking their tail at you in triumph. All I can do is jump at them, barking for them to come down and play, but they never do. Cats would be great if they were a bit more dog-like. I'm told some dogs live quite happily with cats in their very own home. I am safe from this fate, as cats get up my male human's nose just as much as they do mine. And he starts sneezing until he cries. My female human told him it's a good thing it's cats he's allergic to and not dogs, or it would have been a very difficult decision for her. Anyway, next time you are out and about with your dog, spare a thought for them and their struggle to recognise their own species. Still, one good thing, you can always tell a human. But you can't tell them much. Oh well, till next time. Dogs and mythology. In Irish mythology, the dog Dorma was said to guard the gates of death. In Greek mythology, the underworld was guarded by Cerberus, a three-headed dog.
Most dog owners know how useful a crate can be in toilet training a puppy. But how long do you use a crate with a dog? Trainer Lynn Richards says there are many reasons why a crate is a useful and even life-saving tool for your whole dog's life.
I've had friends who've said to me, you know, sort of, I've got this problem or whatever it is with the dog, that it's weeing in the house or something, you know. And if I've said to them, why don't you try a crate, you know, a cage, sometimes they've had quite a negative reaction. And there is this reaction of, I don't want my dog in a cage.
They don't understand the nature of a dog, and that's basically what you have to think like and adjust to when you own a dog or when you have a dog living with you. I don't like to use the word own because there's a lot of people now who don't like that word. But if you're going to share your space with a dog, you have to understand their nature. Just like if you share your space with a spouse, you have to understand how they think, and everybody's different. Dogs are naturally venting animals, and they need a small space that's safe and secure, especially when they're young. You know, protection from predators. That's how they view it. And as they get older, that need doesn't diminish. It just changes. It goes from being a small crate to being maybe on a dog bed in the bedroom or wherever you have your dog's place. It's also a training aid. But if they want to go that route with the, I'm not putting my dog in a cage, then I tell them, well, would you leave your 2-3 month old toddler or baby crawling around in your living room floor, or would you put them in a playpen, or would you put them in a crib? Well, there's not a natural answer for that, obviously. And we're equating this dog as a puppy into that same category, basically a diapered baby. Obviously, we're not trying to turn it into a human being, so I'm not putting it there, but it's an equivalent.
What I think it's important for people to understand is the dog sees that crate as its refuge, doesn't it? If you do it right.
Absolutely. If it's done properly,
It's a refuge and a safe haven and a place of comfort.
Well,
let me give you an example. Let me give you a quick example.
Okay.
You have a visitor to your home. And your dog is fairly young, and you bring a bunch of, you know, running children into your house, and the dog is not used to that. A well-trained, pre-trained dog will simply go to their crate and lie down. Rather than be intimidated or afraid of the children, or possibly even biting children because of its fear. Versus the dog that doesn't understand it has a place to go, doesn't have a place where it can be safe, it may turn around and bite to protect itself.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, we when our dog came to live with us, he was virtually 8 weeks, and we very gently introduced him to the crate, you know, made it a very positive thing, and he knew he got treats and things, and he would sort of jump in the crate and look at you and sort of say, look, any chance of biscuits? Because I'm in this crate, I'm doing it, you know.
Absolutely. And that's a way to introduce a dog that has never been crated when you bring it home to the crate. And I would never take a dog that was 1 or 2 years old that you've been rescued and throw him in a crate and lock the door and walk away. Because that would be like tantamount to locking a human being in a jail. That would be a true dog in a cage scenario. But you can introduce them to it and teach them that it's a place where good things happen. And eventually, and the reason I tell you that it's a safe place to be when the dog, when you're not with the dog, when you're away, I'll give you a couple scenarios. I'm a dog trainer. I've been training a long time, and I've had to deal with students a lot who have that same point of view. And I'll give you an example of one and what happened. She owned a Dalmatian. Dalmatian used to tear up their couch. They came to me for help. My response was, let's crate train the dog. Started to do it with limited success, but they didn't follow through. Obviously, the follow through of the owner is tantamount to making it work, paramount to making it work. Anyway, the dog, one of its little habits was to run through the front door when the postman came. That was one of the habits that we were trying to break, and we had successfully taught the dog that it wasn't to go through a door until a human went first and allowed it to go through. This one day, they left the dog alone, loose in the house, because they still weren't really happy. And the postman came and, I guess, had rung the bell several times because he had a package and he wanted it signed for, didn't know they weren't home. The dog launched himself through the big bay window and, in the process, sliced his throat and died.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this dog was 5 years old. Anybody would say, oh, my dog doesn't need to be crated. He's an adult. Even if it was a well-trained dog and wasn't tearing up the couch. My response is, if you've got your dog in a place that's safe, I mean, short of having a fire in the house, and even then, I on my house have little signs that say fire to the firemen what room the dogs are in and where they're at. And I make sure to check there. Crates are much safer than having that happen to your dog or any of the other scenarios that can occur when you're not home. And if they're in a crate and your firemen can get to them, at least they can drag the crate out of the house and save your dog versus dealing with a dog that may be snarling, growling, and biting, and the police don't have to come in and shoot it.
Yeah.
So there's many reasons why a crate is a much safer place to have your dog, including traveling with a large dog and having the dog be a bullet through the window if something happens and an accident occurs.
I mean, that was something else I wanted to cover. Can you use a crate, you know, if you've got a very small dog or a very large dog, can you still use a crate?
Absolutely, you should use a crate. The larger the dog is, the more reason there would be to use a crate. I'll give you a scenario. My husband's disabled. Most of the time he's fine, he can get around. But he's had instances where he's been hurt and we've needed to get help to him. If I'm on the other side of town, an hour away, and I call emergency services to get over there to help him, and I have that two Great Danes rolling around the house, are they going to want to walk in the door?
No. Yeah.
So if I have my dogs trained to crate up when on the word, and they stay there on the word, even if you can't get there to lock the door behind them, I mean, my husband could speak. He could call me on the phone. He couldn't get up. He said, crate up. Dogs, they ran into their crate, and most of the time they can even, when they jump in, their body motion will close the door behind them, and they just get in there and they go to sleep. And with a smaller dog, it's even more important, and I'll give you the other scenario. If you've got a dog that's easily crate trained and you want to go someplace, you don't have the constrictions of having to put them in a kennel or having to leave them with somebody. If your dog is crate trained, there's many hotels It will allow you to take a well-trained, pre-trained dog with you.
Uh-huh.
And if you're in a car accident and your dog's in a crate, they're much likely less likely to be killed or harmed or run into traffic and get killed if they're already confined to a crate in the car.
Yeah. I think there are so many advantages to the crate training, and the as you say, it's a tool to use. You know, it's one of many tools, but it is a tool, and used properly, it's just right. So valuable.
I would tell people never abuse it. When you're active in your home and you're with your dogs, don't crate them and lock them away. That's just wrong. I mean, you know, you don't want to anti-socialize them. On the other hand, you want to make sure that if there's too many people in the house, that they have a place of refuge, and that's why it's so important.
You know, we've sort of said that if the breeder has used a crate with the litter and they're used to it from the word go, and you bring them home, you know, that's you're following on from that, and that's great. If you have an older dog, particularly as you say, you've one that you've rescued, you can still introduce the crate to them.
Sure, and if you have one that's got a crate fear, you can still introduce them to the crate, but it takes a lot longer. I have my students, when I'm working with somebody who's got a dog in that situation, feed the dog in the crate with the door open. In fact, I have them take the door off because the dog doesn't even hit it and doesn't make a sound. And if you get one of the plastic kennels that has the top that removes, it's even better than the metal ones. You just unscrew the top, so the crate is virtually open except for the very bottom and the three sides.
Uh-huh.
And you place the dog's dish in that kennel. And eventually the dog becomes used to eating in that kennel, and then you can lay the top on top and screw the top on, but still don't put the door on. Still feed the dog in it. Never lock the dog in it.
Mm.
And after a series of weeks goes by, or days, or depending on the dog's acclimation, you can screw on the door, put the dog's dish in there, let the dog go in to eat it, close the door loosely behind it so that if it wants to, when it's done, it can come out.
Mm.
And then that's how you slowly acclimate them to the use of the crate without being stressed out. So it takes time in a situation where you've got a dog that's afraid, for instance.
Mm.
But in some dogs that are rescued, they've been in a kennel for so long, it's no big deal to go into a crate.
Mm. Yeah.
Those are the ones you have to try to coax them out of it. Have them spend some time with human beings, because that is a safe place. You want to make sure if you're going to leave the dog in the crate, like at night when they're sleeping, to get them used to it, put it in the room with people. Don't put them someplace by themselves. Dogs are very social creatures, and they get very sad and very stressed if they're put away from people. So make sure the crate is kept in a room where people are and are near, so that they aren't lonely.
Yeah, I just think it's so important that people understand it's a place that the dog will like. You know, if you do it properly, as we've said, you don't abuse it, but it is a place the dog will like.
Absolutely. Pretty much, I think it's just a matter of how you look at it. I mean, if you look at putting your child in a playpen as imprisoning them, then that's what you're doing. If you're looking at it as a place to protect them and using it as little as it's needed to protect the child, then you're doing a great thing by the child. And that same thing applies to using a crate for a dog.
There's a lot to think about in that interview. If you've never considered a crate, then maybe now's the time to think about one. If you'd like to find out more, there's a link on the Dogcast site to Lynn Richards' site.
Dogs and mythology. In Greek mythology, Canis Major and Canis Minor are the two dogs of Orion, the great hunter.
Hello, and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk with me, Nick.
And me, Kate. Today we look at poop power in San Francisco.
And more celebrity doggy antics. But first, we have the worst dog that has become a bestseller.
If you live with a dog, you'll know the ups and downs that come with a canine companion. If you live with a mischievous dog, those ups and downs are even more extreme. However, it seems that the perils of sharing your home with a misbehaving dog have captured the imagination of the book lovers of America. John Grogan's book, Marley and Me, Life and Love with the World's Worst Dog, has been in the New York Times bestseller list for 17 weeks. When John mentioned Marley, a yellow Labrador, in his column, he was overwhelmed by the 800 responses he got. He wrote the book about Marley, and he also has a website where fellow sufferers can post their own experiences of dog naughtiness. Marley went through life like many dogs, sniffing human crotches and eating household fixtures and fittings, oblivious of the upset he was causing. He was expelled from obedience classes and even swallowed an 18-carat gold necklace. The stress of the arrival of the couple's first child almost led to Marley's departure from the home, but he eventually helped John and his wife parent 3 children.
If you'd like to find out more about John's book or his website, there are links on the Dogcast site to both. But beware, very much like Life with a Dog, this book will make you laugh and cry, as John tells Marley's whole story from cute puppyhood up until his death at the age of 13 in 2003. San Francisco is a city that is hot on recycling. 60% of its refuse is recycled, and now it's turning its attention to dog poop. 4% of the city's rubbish is animal waste, and that's 6,500 tons, which is currently dumped into landfill sites. However, under a new scheme, the dog poop could be put to good use. The idea is that the waste products will be put into a methane digester. This will allow the feces to produce methane, which can be used to fuel anything that runs on natural gas, or can be burned to generate electricity. It's a system that many European cities have already put to good use.
Well, with around 240,000 dogs and cats in San Francisco, it's certainly one fuel that's unlikely to run dry at any time soon. Mariah Carey loves her Jack Russell, called Jack, and has hit the headlines before for insisting on nothing less than first-class travel for him. Now Welsh singer Charlotte Church has followed suit, and her companion is tiny Jack Russell puppy called Tina. One thing's for sure, the Jack Russell, though small, is an active terrier and will not take kindly to any attempts to turn him into a handbag-dwelling accessory. So, how is Charlotte coping with her dog, who was a present for her 20th birthday? So far, so good. She was complaining about being tired after staying awake to care for the puppy. Well, welcome to the real world of dog ownership, Charlotte, and keep up the good work.
Actress Natalie Portman, who played Queen Amidala in the latest Star Wars trilogy, adores her dog too. She has a schnauzer poodle crossbred called Noodles. Natalie says she couldn't let Noodles have a girlfriend, as she herself would be too jealous. Meanwhile, actress Keira Knightley, who appears in the latest adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, has her own strange notions. She says that attending the Academy Awards is like being on show at a dog show. She likens herself to a prize poodle at Crufts.
And speaking of Crufts, this weekend sees the 103rd Crufts Dog Show in Birmingham, England. Crufts 2006 runs from the 9th to the 12th of March, including over 180 breeds, competitions such as agility, flyball, obedience and heelwork to music. The Good Citizen Dog Scheme will be featured too. And in the next episode of Dogcast, we'll be bringing you news and interviews from Crufts, catching up on the sounds, atmosphere, and hopefully the behind-the-scenes emotions of the ultimate dog show.
So until then, that's it from us on the news desk.
Dogs and mythology. In Chinese culture, the Fu dog brings happiness and good luck.
We're still adding breeds to our breed profile pages, and at the bottom of each breed page, there's a download button for you to send us your photos of your dog. Remember, we do have a crossbreed page, so whether your dog is a pedigree or a crossbreed, we'd love to see photos of him or her. Do you talk to your dog? I talk to Buddy and I tell him things I wouldn't dream of telling anyone else. If there's something you've only ever told your dog, why not tell us here at Dogcast Radio? It could be something funny, something sad, something as simple as I love you, something that's troubling you, or a dream that you cherish. You know how to get in touch, and if you don't, the methods of contacting us are coming up at the end of the programme. So go on, be brave and share it with us, and it'll stay between me and you and a few thousand other listeners. Won't go any further than that, I promise. Till next time, look after yourself and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What do you get if you cross a sheepdog with a rose? A cauliflower.